Proceed. Are you ready?
Very well.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Weidinger on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to introduce to the court today Michael Swartz, who is from Hennigan, Bennett, and Dorman, and he will be making the argument today for the appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the court, Mr. Swartz.
Thank you.
The way our clock system works, when I turn it on, you'll see the full 20 minutes. When we get to the time you reserve, the yellow light will come on. You can continue speaking, but you will be using, you know, part of your total time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The clerk explained that to me, and I got it right the second time she explained it to me.
Well, let's see if I can turn them on and off correctly.
May it please the court, Michael Swartz on behalf of the appellants, the petitioners below, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to appear before you today. There are two issues. The first issue is mootness. The second issue is the scope of Rule 60A, and I propose to take them in that order. The settlement in this matter rendered moot respondents' apparent discontent with the pre-settlement determination of fair value. On page 5 of its brief, the respondent, I believe, concedes that justiciability issues such as mootness are reviewed de novo, as we had established in our opening brief. There was a settlement agreement here. It said, and I quote, "This letter memorializes the terms of the parties' agreement to fully and finally resolve," and that ends the quote, "the two actions, the fiduciary duty action and the appraisal action." The consequences of that to my clients were significant. As a result of the settlement agreement, no appeal was brought. As a result, all appellate challenges were waived against both the respondent in the appraisal action and against defendant Turner in the related fiduciary duty action, both of which were settled by the same agreement. As the Court of Chancery said in its Rule 60A opinion that we're here about, those appellate rights were substantial. They were not insignificant. Respondent also had benefits and consequences from that settlement. It received the disputed shares that we had been holding throughout the litigation. It paid cash, and it avoided further litigation by way of appeal or otherwise. As the Court of Chancery said, by settling, the parties, quote, "voluntarily assumed the risk that the court's adjudication may have been flawed." Respondents gave up the right to litigate further the appraisal action.
Now, this is not an academic appeal. I assume that your interest here is that someone's not going to try to suggest part of the money has to be returned. Is that correct?
I assume that at some point they will suggest that. They have indeed suggested that. I believe that this appeal nonetheless qualifies as academic under the mootness test, because the prerequisite for this case becoming ripe at some point would be overturning the appeal. Our position, and I think it's correct under Delaware law, is that the dispute has to have a meaning when it's resolved, that a dispute is academic unless it'll have a real-world impact, that Delaware courts do not resolve questions that might theoretically matter to someone someday.
What about the integrity of the court's own work product? Let's assume that there's a typographical errors that no one would really disagree with, that it's just misspellings, rife misspellings throughout the opinion. The case settles, and then the court somehow finds out that, look at that, you spelled this person's name wrong, you did this and did that. It's just going to be a better work product for this opinion to be corrected so that it's going to be in the West Reporter system. Are you saying that as a result of the settlement, a true, undisputable misspelling, that type of clerical error, could not be corrected by the court on its own initiative?
No. With regard to a spelling error, I do not think that there's any problem with a court correcting a spelling error. It is a change that has a meaning that the court cannot correct. And I think that when parties settle, that Delaware law establishes in the Tyson case and in the Warren versus Moore case by Chancellor Chandler, and looking at the federal cases the Sixth Circuit's opinion in International Union in particular, that a settlement renders moot the disputes that are settled.
Okay, and but if it's a clerical error within the scope of 60A, and I know you're going to address that, but if it is within the scope of 60A, the court, to preserve the integrity of its own opinions and decisions, could correct it.
I do not believe so. I do not believe that the court can correct a error that has any meaning. So if your name or my name or somebody else's name was misspelled, I think that can be corrected. But I do not think that the court has any power over a settled dispute. The way to deal with errors in long-resolved cases, or even briefly resolved cases, settled cases, is that somebody can write an article, they can write a letter, they can let people know that they think it is a mistake. People are often discussing.
My focus was assume it's within the scope of 60A.
Correct. I do not believe that 60A is applicable to settled cases. I think that when 60A says at any time, like many other provisions of the Rules of Civil Procedure, it is talking about things that can be done at any time in cases that are not moot, where the impact can have meaning. And that in this context, it was important to establish because courts should not take up issues where that may be complicated.
Well, when you say, an amendment that has meaning, you mean an amendment or a change that affects someone's substantive rights. It may be very meaningful to me to have my name spelled correctly, particularly if I'm the victorious party, in a litigation that is, that results in some judgment thereafter and thereafter is settled. It may not be substantively significant, however. So what are we talking about here?
I agree. I think it has to affect a substantive right so that the movement of dollars would qualify. A decision that determines that the fair value used to be $32 in some odd cents and the changes it so that the fair value is now $30 in some odd cents, that's a substantive change. The case is moot. We're not supposed to proceed to doing that under Rule 60A or another rule. Unless your honors have further questions, I'll move on to Rule 60A, the second issue before us. There are a variety of procedures for fixing errors. The first one that comes to mind is Rule 59, a motion for new trial. This is a rule that allows you to fix substantive errors, but you have to make a motion promptly. Similarly, you can attack substantive errors through an appeal, but you have to do so promptly. There's a 60B. 60B also applies to certain kinds of mistakes, certain kinds of inadvertence, but it applies more broadly than Rule 60A, and unsurprisingly, it has its own limits so that the finality of judgments is preserved. 60B requires, under Delaware law, extraordinary circumstances involving excusable neglect, but in any event, you have to move without unreasonable delay. Case law established that the respondents couldn't use 60B here, so they didn't try. They moved under 60A. 60A is the narrowest of the rules. It has the narrowest scope because it doesn't have a time limit. The case is established that it has a narrow scope because it has no time limit. The narrowness is necessary to preserve the finality of judgments. The Dixon versus Delaware Olds case is instructive here. It talks about how you have to figure out whether it's a Rule 60 issue or a Rule 59 or appeal issue because it would be improper, given the finality of judgments, to shove too many things into Rule 60. Rule 60A only applies to mechanical errors that a clerk might make. It doesn't have to have been made by a clerk, but it has to be something that a clerk might have done. It cannot involve an error of, quote, substantive judgment, as the Third Circuit said in FISA.
In that regard, there are a number of metaphors that have appeared in the opinion of the Vice Chancellor and in the briefs as to what is or what isn't a substantive change, that is, a Rule 60. What is or what isn't a Rule 60A a clerical or computational error?
Yes.
One of the metaphors is I guess it relies on the world of mathematics, and that is that if the court in its opinion, declares that the law operates according to a certain formula, let's say that that formula is mathematical, and the court makes it clear how that formula is supposed to work, but somehow inputs by mistake the wrong number into the formula, and it's clear on the face of the opinion that that's what happened. Rule 60A or 60B?
Rule 60A applies. There may be circumstances where you could use 60B.
So isn't the issue here, if we can drag out this metaphor a little bit more, whether or not the court in its opinion, in its substantive appraisal opinion, basically laid out the formula for how the NOLs should be and should not be treated?
I think that is one of the central issues.
Okay, wasn't that done here?
I don't believe it was done. I think that if you read the footnote 80 that respondent has pointed us to, where it claims that the court said that it would be normalizing the terminal years to do away with net operating losses that could not be carried forward into perpetuity, the footnote doesn't say that. The footnote does not talk in any manner about normalizing the terminal year.
The footnote, which is the only place in the opinion, or at least as I see it, the only place in the opinion that squarely addresses this problem, is very short. And it says, the NOLs, as carried forward during the projection period, are used to reduce tax liability and thus increase cash flow. After the projection period, the NOLs, until they are fully consumed, reduce the tax liability. That tax savings must be reduced to a lump sum present value. Thus, the ultimate value of the NOLs depends upon the tax rate.
Yes. I believe that that footnote is talking about something very important, which is how the court's going to go about valuing the net operating loss that remained after the projection period.
It also talks about, it makes it clear that the NOLs can be used after the projection period until they are fully consumed.
Correct. It does not.
Implying that after they're fully consumed, they may not be.
I completely agree with that, Your Honor. It does not, however, imply that the terminal year will be normalized. It does not say that the terminal year will be adjusted so that there will be no impact of the net operating loss. The terminal year wasn't normalized for other issues. It wasn't normalized, as we had requested, for capital expenditures and depreciation. Those figures were not set so that they could be carried forward into perpetuity. They were set in a manner that did not allow that. The normalization topic, the topic of finding a terminal year set of numbers that could be carried forward into perpetuity, that would allow a Gordon growth valuation of the perpetuity period, was not discussed in the opinion. Yes, net operating loss was discussed. Yes, the fact that net operating loss would disappear was discussed. But the fact that there would need to be an adjustment to the terminal year was not discussed.
Isn't that implicit in the footnote?
I do not believe it is. And the issue of whether it's implicit is important. Case law establishes, and I point to the law offices of William McVeigh case and the Pratt versus Petroleum Products case, both establish that you cannot apply Rule 60A where there's any uncertainty about whether the pre-motion record establishes the nature of the mistake. And here I believe there is at least uncertainty. In fact, I believe it's pretty clear, actually, that he was not discussing normalizing. It would have been hard to explain why the Vice Chancellor would have been discussing normalizing of net operating losses if he was not going to be discussing other normalizations that we had asked for the terminal year. Not only the error, however, needs to be of a certain type. The method of fixing the error has to be of a certain type. The cases talk about how you can't engage in cerebration. I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about what cerebration is, and I think it's the task where you move your thinking cap from the clerk's chair to the judge's chair. So if you're engaged in substantive thought that you would only think appropriate for a judge to do, not something that might have been mistyped, not something that might have been misentered on a calculator, but something that involves determining how something should be corrected, you've moved into the judge's chair. You can't do that under Rule 60A. This case involves a series of changes that had to be made. You had to make a substantive change by adding a new column of terminal year numbers, one that didn't even exist in the Vice Chancellor's original opinion, and that was explained for the Vice Chancellor's benefit by a declaration from an expert that respondent provided to explain how the normalization should have taken place. The normalization would have had to consider whether to normalize capital expenditures and depreciation. And after the normalization was done, the judge still has to keep his judicial thinking cap on, his non-clerical thinking cap on, because he needs to, under Delaware law, make sure that other metrics, other tools of valuation, do not suggest a different conclusion.
Well, wouldn't that be the case with any formula or the correction of an input to any formula?
I do not believe so. There are examples where the formula governs how much you're going to receive. You're going to receive this much for rent. You're going to receive this much for other expenses. You're going to add up those numbers. That's how much you're going to receive. Here, in the fair value context, it's more than running the numbers, as the Vice Chancellor said, and as Delaware case law provided. You have to use reason. You have to consider other metrics. And here, when he went back to consider other metrics, he was answering a question that he had never been forced to contemplate before, whether a lower value was appropriate given those metrics. A clerk couldn't do that. A clerk wouldn't think it was appropriate. Only a judge using judicial reasoning could engage in the kind of cerebration, for lack of a better word, that would allow him to determine whether this correction could be made and what its final impact would be on fair value. The cases that allow Rule 68 corrections are very limited. They point, in this case, respondent points to WT versus BT. In WT versus BT, the court corrected an alimony figure, a rent figure in an alimony correction, in an alimony calculation, and it determined that no correction was necessary. But there, the formula yielded the result. That's not the case here. The formula did not yield the definitive result. With that, Your Honor, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. John Abramczyk, appearing on behalf of the Appley Dr. Pepper Bottling Company of Texas. May it please the court. Sort of an extraordinary afternoon, with all due respect. This case comes before the court on a very narrow issue of whether the trial court properly exercised its inherent authority under Rule 60A to ensure that the conclusion is in the opinion that the court wrote accurately reflected what was in the holdings. And the appellant comes before the court today and asks this honorable court not only to reshape what the language of the rule is in a way, but also to sort of turn at least 100 years of law on its head by saying that there are circumstances in which when an underlying dispute goes away, the lower court loses its power, the inherent power, under Rule 60A to make corrections.
Well, you mentioned that twice. There's some thought that inherent authority exists in and of itself, and you don't need Rule 60A to justify it. I just want to make sure I understand your point, which the way I read your briefs seems to say, notwithstanding the text of 60A, if it's brought to the court's attention that there's this conflict, internal conflict that was unintended in the court's opinion, even without the rule, the court has the inherent authority to fix it.
Your Honor, we would say precisely even without the parties applying to the court to fix it, that the court does have the inherent authority because the language of the rule actually is very clear on this. And the language says that clerical mistakes in judgments, order, or any other part of the record or errors arising therein may be corrected by the court at any time of its own initiative or on the motion of any party and after such notice of the court.
But I understand, and my question is that you seem to be making two arguments. The text of the rule permits this, but independent of the rule, the court had inherent authority to do it on its own motion or otherwise.
We do, Your Honor, on its own motion or otherwise. Yes, that's correct. And so it seems fair to quickly move to the question that I think the appellant spends most of his time on, which is, so what kinds of corrections are allowable under Rule 60A? And is the mistake that was corrected here correctable under Rule 60A? Or said differently, is Rule 60A just too narrow to allow the correction that was made here? And what is clear from the case law on how the court goes about evaluating the scope of Rule 60A is that the court under Rule 60A has to examine whether its intent is ascertained on the record and reveals that the errors that are in the conclusion or wherever they are in the opinion were inconsistent with the pronounced adjudication of the court. And the error was a result of incorrectly translating that holding into the conclusion in the opinion. It said in one sentence that the goal of this rule is to allow the court to correct the opinion so that it speaks the truth, and we look to the text of the opinion to determine the intent of the court to find out whether the intent is clearly expressed in the opinion. And when you apply that test here, as the Vice Chancellor did in his opinion below, the answer is apparent, that here we have the luxury of having an opinion below that very clearly addresses this precise issue that we moved under Rule 60 to have corrected, and that is the treatment of the NOLs. Because to a certain extent, the appellants have a point here. They would say, if this required an excursion back into the law or into methodology, or if we had come before this court and said we wanted to change the methodology or do normalization, for example, which the court didn't do, it would be a different story. But here, we're coming before the court and saying, in our Rule 60 motion, we came before the court below and said, look, the opinion is quite clear as to how the court intended to treat the net operating losses, and it's in the footnote 80, as Justice Jacobs read. And there is a complete explanation in this case from the court below of how the court intended to deal with that issue. The mistake, the error that crept in, and I think everybody agrees there was an error in the opinion, the error that crept in was in the computational mistake made from translating what the court's holding was onto the conclusion that was listed in this particular case in that Exhibit A. And that's all we came before the court asking to have corrected, and that is indeed all the court did in correcting it.
Well, the response to the argument that you're making is, number one, that the court's intention was not clear from the footnote that I read from, number two, that in order to, you know, connect the dots between the footnote and the bottom line of the change that was actually made under Rule 60A, some cerebration was required, a lot of it.
Well, to address the two points. First, Your Honor, what is clear here, not only from footnote 80, but from the court's opinion below, is that the Vice Chancellor looked back at this issue, and he very plainly says in his opinion, I know what I was intending to do below. Here's where my intent is reflected in the opinion. He says that it's two different places in his opinion on this particular issue. I knew what I intended to do, and this is what I intended to do. So whether appellant now come before this court and say footnote 80 is ambiguous is difficult to square with the language of the rule that says, look, what you've got to do is, if the court finds an error, he can correct it. And when you test that, the way to test that is, what did the court intend to do? And the court himself says, what I intended to do is what's in footnote 80, and this is what it is.
Well, let's you know, it sounds to me like you're dropping back now from Rule 60A to inherent authority. Let's stick to Rule 60A, because that was the format. That is the framework in which this entire problem was analyzed and resolved. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And under Rule 60A, it's not enough for the judge to say, well, I know what I was thinking when I wrote that opinion. There has to be more than that, doesn't there? That is, the opinion itself has got to set forth the formula that would lead to the correct result.
Right, and that goes to the second part of Your Honor's question, which is, so wasn't this something that required too much cerebration to really get there? And the answer is, it certainly, in this case, the record is clear that it certainly did not. And the reason is because we don't come before the court asking for additional analysis to go into this. This is strictly saying, this is what the opinion said the court tried to do. This is what's reflected when it was written down. That's where the error is. We're not coming in saying, use a different approach, change the discount rate, rerun the formulas, do some normalization. That's not at all. That's not at all the subject of the Rule 60A motion here. The subject of the motion was simply, we accept, as we must, the court's analysis here. What we ask the court to do under Rule 60A is ensure that the analysis is properly reflected in the opinion, and it is here, as for all the reasons that Vice Chancellor Noble records in his opinion here.
So you seem to be suggesting that if we look at the text of the opinion and the exhibit, they're inconsistent, and that in any situation where you have an internal inconsistency, it's appropriate to ask the court to reconcile the inconsistency in a Rule 60A motion.
Yes, and I think that in this particular case, it's a very straightforward application of the rule, because the very specific inconsistency was addressed in plain language by the court in its opinion, and the error was equally plain when you see the translational effect of that.
And I ask the question in general terms because I understand this involves a computation, but it's possible there will be other situations where there are inconsistencies. In fact, our court has remanded cases to trial courts because we've seen an inconsistency and we've said, please explain to us how you reconcile this.
That's right. And I think where the line gets drawn, Your Honor, on those things, there are, I think the weight of the authority in these Rule 60A cases are cases that seem to come up in sort of how interest is to be calculated and what you do with interest. And the courts are very careful to distinguish between whether the court substantively awarded interest, whether what the court said about that, whether it's within the range of what the rates would be applicable. Those sorts of things get far closer to the line of whether they're appropriate corrections than what we have in this particular case, because what we have in this particular case is simply the error. And the court below, in his opinion, wrote it this way. The vice chancellor says, I find, even though this is a complex formula, that you're not asking me to change the complex formula, that my intent is clear on the record, and I believe that the error that I need to correct here is of the type that can be correctable here. It is a computational error, which clearly falls under the rubric of clerical mistakes in Rule 60A. I view it as a clerical error because my intent is clear on the opinion, and therefore I'm going to fix it. And that is precisely the proper application of Rule 60A.
Isn't there an implicit analysis that goes with that, that, oh, now the number is this, is it still what I intended in terms of other valuation methods? And isn't that cerebration?
Well, I suppose on the cerebration point, Your Honor, it's difficult to sort of leave it at just that, cerebration as the test, because indeed correction of anything, I mean, walking into the clerk's office certainly requires certain cerebration because you have to know where you're going. And, you know, you sort of go up from there as to sort of how much thought is required. Where I think the cases under Rule 60A make the distinction is when a litigant comes before the court and asks for a substantive correction and says, look, you've got to change this because this is what I wanted it to say, and that's not what the opinion says. The difference here is striking in that we have an opinion that very clearly says what the court wanted to do on the particular issue in which there was an error, and so it becomes a very straightforward application of Rule 60A to say, of course that's a clerical mistake, of course these opinions are public record. I have the both power and responsibility as the trial judge here to correct this record so it accurately reflects what I held in the opinion.
Well, what are the implications of the correction from your perspective?
Well, Your Honor, on this particular motion, there are no implications other than the opinion gets corrected. What we came before the court below to ask was to say, we need the opinion corrected, and the court was very careful in his opinion to say, I think more than once, that all All the court was doing here is correcting the opinion. Indeed, there's no record below on other issues.
Well, there's no need for the opinion corrected. The case is settled. Why do you need the opinion corrected?
Well, there is a live issue as to whether the case was settled, Your Honor. And as you know from the opinion, the court below put his finger on that as well and said, look, I'm faced with these arguments about the case below being settled. I don't really have to resolve them here. And no matter how I resolve them, even if I accept appellant's argument here and say that there was a settlement, doesn't matter because I still have the authority under Rule 60A to correct the opinion. So that's where that issue comes. Well,
we get phone calls periodically from attorneys after we issue opinions just to the clerk's office that say, you know, he should have been she or something else like that. And there's no real motion. It's just we wanted the court to know, and sometimes we fix those and we appreciate the call. Is that the innocuous type of helpful information that was being called to the court's of Chancery's attention here, or does it have substantive implications to the extent the Court of Chancery acted on the information that was brought to its attention? Or is that to be decided?
It's to be decided. I think it's too early to tell. Clearly, this is of a different nature than a call to fix a pronoun in an opinion or maybe an obviously erroneous date. We don't stand before the court and say this is just so, you know, obvious typographical sort of error. But importantly, Rule 60A isn't limited to those kinds of errors, and that's why we say this.
Let's follow up on Justice Holland's question, which I took to mean, and if he didn't, I'll ask it directly. In the real world, what are the implications of an affirmance of the Vice Chancellor's ruling? What's going to happen next?
Well, Your Honor, what I think will happen next is we will examine, and again, be forced to build a record on whether there's a basis on which we can recover the overpayment that was made as a base from the underlying overpayment that was made here with the carrying of that error.
So but again, one of the substantive implications would be that it may or will generate a claim to recover the overpayment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But again, I think it is important for us to be very specific that issue is yet to be developed, hasn't yet even been brought, yet to be developed, and is not before the court today. Unless there are further questions from the court, we respectfully request that the Court of Chancery's decision be affirmed. The appellants have brought forth no authority here today on which they should be allowed to strip the lower court of its inherent authority to correct its own opinions under Rule 60A.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the respondent made the point that the record's not yet developed about whether this will have a real-world impact. That's correct. That's why it's moot and not yet ripe. Moving on to Rule 60A, the respondent indicated that the court didn't say it wanted to do a normalization that wouldn't have been allowed under Rule 60A. That's what the court did. It normalized the terminal year. It wasn't allowed to do that. That was substantive. The analogy was made to connecting dots, and respondent seemed to indicate that it was something like that. This is a lot more than connecting dots. There's a lot going on here where the respondent can't explain how the vice chancellor could move from even having corrected this error, having identified the error, to a final result that determines a fair value here. The movement to the bottom line is going to be very challenging without engaging in cerebration, without engaging in judicial thinking. You would have to decide whether or how to normalize. You'd have to decide how to normalize, whether to do it the way our expert did, which was different from the way the vice chancellor did. It matters, changes the values by hundreds of thousands of dollars. You have to decide about the other metrics. Is this a substantive change? It's a substantive change in the amount of more than $2 million. It's not spelling. It's not gender. And what we have here in addition to the fact that it's a lot of money and therefore substantive, is the fact that the thought was substantive. You had to decide how to implement correct financial theory to recognize that you should not do a Gordon growth method without accounting for the fact that the NOL would disappear, something that wasn't discussed.
Mr. Swartz, in other counsel's presentation, I believe it was Justice Holland that asked whether Rule 60 argument, 60A argument, was really bifurcated. That is, that it had two prongs. One was under Rule 60A, and the other was under the court's inherent power. And I think the response was that both arguments were being made here. That is, the court could do what it did both under the rule and under its inherent power. My question to you is, was the inherent power argument raised below?
Absolutely not. It was, they may have said something about inherent power, but the only issues that were argued and briefed, other than perhaps a word or two saying inherent power somewhere, is here. The issues that were briefed was Rule 60A and its scope. Last point I'd like to make is...
Is Rule 60A any different from inherent power?
I think it was evolved from a notion of inherent power, but I think that the rules now set forth the court's ability to make corrections, except perhaps for spelling and gender corrections.
Sets forth the conditions for the exercise of that power.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and will recess.